Okay, well, on behalf of the Vancouver List Music Group, I'd like to welcome Gregor Tikdalis to our meeting. Gregor's one of the legends of the List world. His book, The Art of the Metaoptimist Protocol, is one of the key texts that virtually every team Lister has on his bookshelf. He's also well known outside of List circles for the work that he's done on aspect-oriented programming. He's currently a professor at UBC, and the format of the meeting will be that it's a question and answer sort of session. People will present questions to Gregor, and hopefully Gregor will answer them. To start off with, and to set the stage a bit, I wonder, Gregor, if you could just review some of the history around the work that you did in developing the ECL Metaoptic Protocol and the book, The Art of the Metaoptic Protocol, and put it into some sort of historical context. What were precedents or what were contributing concepts or ideas that led you to the development of that? And how did the development of the MOP proceed?
So I guess we sort of started working on it in kind of 85 or 86, I guess. There were sort of two projects at the same time. There was what became the Common Lisp Object System project that started out at Xerox as the Common Loops project. And what happened was there were sort of three or four competing proposals for an object standard in Common Lisp. There was the Xerox Common Loop standard, there was the Symolex Loop Labeling standard, and then there were a couple other. Henry Lieberman had a system and Gary Drescher had a system. And the new flavors proposal and the Common Loop proposal were sort of relatively close to each other. So those two groups got together to sort of make the actual Common Loop Object System standard. So there were, I guess, five or six people who were the official designers of the Common Lisp Object System standard, the authors of that report. And then I was working on a portable implementation of it, PCL, and I was also one of the designers. And so PCL sort of had ideas in it that were the official standard and ideas in it that were sort of Xerox ideas. It was all open source and da-da-da-da-da back before anybody sort of used those words. There was a little bit of competition as to whose standard was coming out on top. But basically, you had the Symolex group and the Xerox group. So those were the two big groups. And so in terms of the MetaObject protocol stuff, I think what was going on was... It's a long time ago. I was really concerned with expressivity. I've always been concerned with expressivity, what makes programs look good. And at the time, I was really concerned with language extensibility, because it seemed to me that language extensibility was a very powerful way of making programs look good. At Park at the time, you had Brian Smith kicking around, who had sort of done the three list work. So his ideas were sort of in the air, and I was, originally I was not in his group, but by the time we wrote the book, I was in his group. And you also had the Smalltalk people kicking around, and they of course had their own kind of metaobject protocol. And Loops kind of had its own metaobject protocol too, so all these ideas were kind of in the air. And we just were trying to figure out how to get them into this PCL system, and make a good trade-off between ability to extend the language and efficiency. My big thing at the time was, I'd like you to be able to have these neat ideas, but not give up any efficiency. You have to remember this was before Java, right? So at the time, the Lisp people were getting pounded over single instruction, your thing is one instruction slower than C code, so we'll never use it. Your thing has a 10 megabyte footprint, so we'll never use it. It's all kind of ironic. given that people use Java today, but at the time we were getting pounded over this. So efficiency was a big thing. So kind of, I think the Manhattan Protocol work just grew out of all these ideas being in the air and trying to engineer the best version of those ideas that we could at the time.
At one stage you wrote, and I'm quoting this from an email that you you posted on, I think it was Comp Planning List or Comp Planning Plus a while back. You said, the MOC is a very powerful tool and it should in general be used sparingly. One good way to think about using the MOC is to realize that what it allows you to do is to create an alternative programming language. So before using the MOC, ask yourself the question, do I need to define an alternative programming language for this problem, or is standard clause good enough? I found that posing the question this way provides a proper bias towards being conservative about the use of the MOC. On the other hand, there are many ways to use the MOC which have a quite subtle effect. In these cases, the effect isn't so much to create an alternative language as it is to give a better handle on the existing language. That is, even though it appears to be a big hammer, it can be used quite delicately. End quote. Okay, so looking through some code and documents for examples of the types of things that MOCs can use for, I found a number of different things that I could use as examples just to throw out. For example, using creating atomic update primitives for synchronized computational threads to CLOS, adding slot persistence to CLOS, another one, commonly put forward as an example, altering the implementation of multiple inheritance in CLOS to override defaults for how superclass conflicts are resolved, implementing aspect-oriented programming languages, creating a MOC-based compiler for Scheme, creating fault-tolerant classes for corporate transactions, using the MOC to optimize certain CLOS characteristics for improved application performance for specific applications. So those are just sort of things I'm just sort of throwing out as examples. What are some things that you've always thought the MOC could be used for, but that you haven't seen implemented yet? That you really think, well, that'll be a monster for use for the MOC that I haven't seen done yet?
I thought your question was going to go a different way.
You didn't answer the question you thought I was asking.
I had a good answer for where I thought you were going. I mean, those seem like good examples. I haven't thought much about using it for a while. Where I thought you were going to go is sort of, you know, do I still believe sort of that that's the right trade-off in using it? And I guess what I was going to say is what I've come to believe is, I mean, at the end of the day, it's really, there seem to be sort of two groups of people. There's people who can do metalinguistic abstraction without being taught very much, and there's people who have a hard time doing metalinguistic abstraction no matter how much you teach them. And ultimately, I think some of why I myself moved away from language extensibility work is I haven't yet figured out how to teach people who don't know how to design their own mini languages to design their own mini languages. I mean, roughly, there's the people who pick up structure interpretation of computer programs and get it, and immediately say, oh yeah, macros, da-da-da-da. And they write some bad ones, but after a while, they mostly write good ones. Good macros, that is. And then there's people for whom language extensibility is just really hard. So I think if, you know what I was, I think that what I was really trying to say in that note is, if you know how to do language extensibility and this tool will do it, then go ahead. And if you don't know how to do language extensibility and or this tool won't do it, then by all means stop. It's just, I've never found that there's any really sort of crisp ways of saying, yeah, you made a little mini language there and it was a good idea, versus you made a little mini language there and boy, that was a bad idea. So I think that's one of the things that, I think that's one of the reasons why they made the right choice about not putting a real MOC in Java, because I think that their user base was so large that they would have gotten a lot of bad results.
How do you sort of on that same same note, how do you feel about languages designed for the masses as opposed to languages designed for people that do know how to use something like a Metalfi protocol to create their own languages?
I'm not sure what the question is.
You were saying that you thought that the way I was just raising the question was revolved around why you moved away from Metalfi. How do you feel now about that?
I don't know. Part of me thinks that things might be about to change, actually, because
Tom felt like the Earth got put their hands up and cheered.
Yeah, it's not change isn't going to come from there.
Sorry, guys.
Well, the way the change is going to work, if it works, is going to be the way it always works, right? And the classic example is to look at the two small talk companies that existed before Java and the one that still exists. Right? There was OTI and Parseplex. And OTI took one look at Java and said, we should declare victory. And Parseplex took one look at Java and said, no, that's not right. And the OTI guys have Caribbean islands, and the Parseplex people just got crushed. So the change is going to come that way. Right? The people sitting on compliant lists are going to have an opportunity to see it coming. And if they're willing to let go of all the particulars, which unfortunately one of the particulars will be the params, they'll win. And if they're not willing to let go of the particulars, they'll lose. That's just a side point, my prediction. You know, there's some things that exist in modern tools today that most programmers wouldn't have had words for talking about 10 years ago. One of them is just refactoring. Right? Refactoring is automatic program manipulation, right? It's metaprogramming. It's the kind of metaprogramming that you used to be able to do in Interlisp with MasterScope. All of the modern refactorings existed in Interlisp with MasterScope. But in MasterScope, you had more of a notion that you were actually manipulating program text, right? So that's one thing. The model-based stuff is actually starting to work. So it may be that in 5 years, you can talk to average programmers about making a little DSL and doing analysis on it and generating code off of that. And you won't be talking about hygiene and syntactic macros and, you know, any of the things that we used to think matter. But it'll be the same sort of style of thinking. So that idea may actually be about to come. And if it's about to come, then work like the Metalfi protocol work and all that staged computation work and stuff like that will come into its own. For the masses as opposed to for the specialists. I don't know.
The Metalfi protocol is a language tool. The site Open Implementations, which I believe you were involved with setting up as well, has a comment on it. Metalfi protocols were originally defined as supplemental illustrations of programming languages that could give users the ability to incrementally modify the language's behavior and implementation. More recently, it has become clear that systems other than programming languages can have a Metalfi protocol. In fact, many existing systems can be seen as having ad hoc Metalfi protocols. In one of your papers, you talk about the idea of using MOP-like concepts in the creation of an operating system. What other non-programming language examples have you seen of systems with ad hoc MOPs or that would benefit from ad hoc MOPs?
Well, at the time we wrote a whole report about that. We sort of categorized a bunch of examples. The best examples were in all the different parts of operating systems and network stacks, things like that. All that work kind of became the quality of service work, where you sort of had a functional interface and a quality of service interface. I really, and that really did give rise to the open implementation idea that you sort of want to separate your functional interface, if you ever have any notion of what that word means, and other properties of your interface that might allow you to tune performance trade-offs and stuff like that. And then we went from there, and then that's what took us to aspect-oriented programming, was to think, well, what language mechanisms do you need in general to be able to write such things? Excuse me, but the best examples were in operating systems and protocol stacks and things like that. There may have been others, but that's where we looked. Those were the people who were interested in really delivering performance.
Are you familiar with the work Pascal Tapdanza has been doing?
I know some about it.
Okay, well, for those who aren't familiar, he's the author of a number of MOC-related libraries that are sort of bundled under the umbrella project called the Closer Project, in that he has some MOC feature tests that look at MOC feature functionality across different Lisp implementations. And he has the Closer to MOC, which is a compatibility layer that provides a generic mechanism for accessing MOC across different CL implementations. He has ContextL, which is a context-oriented programming class extension, which is in ContextL. And he has AspectL as well, which is an aspect-oriented programming class extension. He emailed me with the following question for Gregor. He says, when one takes a look at the history of the cross MOP, one can tell that there was a move from a mostly runtime MOP towards a more compile-time MOP. For example, the original cross specification states that generic functions can have their classes changed, but this idea is apparently dropped in the cross MOP spec. The slot access protocol was also changed at the last minute, so to speak, to allow for better compile-time optimization. In general, the cross MOP spec states that meta object classes should be defined before the respective meta objects are instantiated, and afterwards the meta object classes should not be changed anymore. Tiny Claus made even more steps towards a compile time MOP, and ULIP was described on the Xerox parts page as a cleaner design, which had a compile time load time only MOP. How was this move from runtime MOP to exclusively compile time MOP motivated? Was this a concession to the competition from static languages? Was it the ability to change things at runtime not considered important enough?
Well, the simple answer to the question is trivial. Early binding gets you performance. What I'm trying to remember is enough of the details to give more than the simple answer. It's certainly not true that the CLOS MOP is a compile time MOP. What is true is that it's biased towards exploiting the period of time between load time and runtime. It has no meta-level operations in it that give you any kind of representation that would be useful to a compiler. Right? All of the things, compute discriminating function, right, returns a function. It doesn't return a description of a function. And it returns a compiled function. So, unless the compiler is going to get really damn smart, there's no way that at compile time the compiler is going to look at that function and say, oh, I see. I'll build a three-level table data structure. So it's not true that it's compile time MOP. It is true that it's trying to back off of very late runtime. And so, for example, that's why it has compute discriminating function as opposed to just having lookup methods. And that was just all about performance. You really have to remember that before Java came along, performance mattered. Pardon?
Before Windows.
Well, no, that's not fair. Windows, never worked, but it was always fast until recently. At the beginning, it was Boston Tech, and it had a tiny little footprint. You know, the Lyft people were getting just hammered over a 2-3 megabyte footprint. So it looked like you were never going to be able to have a language idea that didn't compete with C.
So while we're on the topic of compilers and that, Dave Roberts asked another question that's related. He said, some of the original MOS papers written by Gregor and others at FARC discussed the use of MOS in things like compilers. How successful were those experiments? How practical in terms of users actually getting utility out of them? I can see great advantages in being able to tune the code generator for particular programs when the user knows the details of what he wants to see emitted. It's surprising that this idea hasn't caught on. The closest I can see in the Lisp world today is SPCL's. Are you familiar with SPCL as a CL implementation? The closest I can see in the Lisp world today is SPCL's VOS, which are personal virtual operations, where a knowledgeable user can effectively get similar behavior. But VOS are crude and clearly an abstraction of a particular compiler implementation, not a clean system like MOS. For those of you that aren't familiar with VOS, they're a mechanism that provides sort of like a macro facility for generating the machine code instructions that would be executed for a particular Lisp instruction. So his question revolves around the use of MOS.
Right. So I'm not sure it's right that idea never took off. There's certainly lots of systems that have Pragma-like interfaces where the programmer has the opportunity to tell the compiler something. I think what's become clear is, and if you look at some of the way the Popple community has gone with this, where you give the compiler a fact that it can then prove, but it doesn't have to deduce. I think one of the things that we've learned about that idea is that if a language is too low level, like say Lisp, that idea is unlikely to win for the following reason, which is that there's so many low-level things the compiler has to do right that if you give it a piece of bad advice, it could totally screw the rest of it. I mean, roughly speaking, Lisp is pretty close to machine code already. So, you know, instruction scheduling has to be done right, and all these other little, tiny little things have to be done right. And if you open up the compiler enough to interfere with that, you may end up saving 10% on an insight, but then losing 50% on detail. So I think if you look, for example, in the quality of service work, like the network protocol quality of service work, you know, you're making fairly high-level declarations, right? You know, this is streaming video data. You're not saying things like, you know, take this exact route through the network. And I think that sort of pragma-style stuff, that sort of advising a smart implementation, sort of always has to have that kind of property, where you say something about what your program's going to do more than you say something about how the system ought to implement itself. And I think maybe that was a thing that was wrong with some of how we were thinking about using the MOS for performance. Because when you use the CLOS MOS for performance, you're really just saying how the language itself should be implemented. And the bottom line is it was hard to do better. Right? You know, if you look, for example, at one of the specific ports of PCL, right? You know, they were looking at, on this hardware I'm going to use these 3 instructions, and on this hardware I'm going to use these 4 instructions. And you know, you come in and say, well, I've got a slightly better hashing strategy. You know, it might even be a slightly better hashing strategy, but you've got a 40 instruction implementation of it, so end of game. So maybe we just weren't quite right about how to think about that idea of open optimization interfaces.
A few questions here from Gary King, who's the author of Mop Philippines, which is a library that provides both a compatibility layer for minor mop implementation differences, and it also adds some handy reflection capabilities. He's got three questions that he wanted to ask you. First is, he says, I'd like to hear about the trade-offs in language design between dynamism, performance, and interactivity, e.g. something like Dylan's Ceiling comes to mind. An ideal mop, an ideal in quotes, mop would allow this to be part of the tuning. So he just wants your thoughts on the trade-offs in language design between those different characteristics, dynamism, performance, and interactivity.
Yeah, that's a trade-off.
Okay, moving on to the next question.
I just don't think I have anything general to say about it.
Okay.
It's always going to turn down to any particular feature, right?
Okay, so this next question is, why no meta language for deaf class? The mop provides ways to extend classes, but not deaf class. This means that you can't extend language easily as you should be able to. And he gives an example of stuff in the GBB Open. What GBB Open does with Define Class, or even the more paltry Deaf Class Star.
You don't need a meta language for Deaf Class because you have Deaf Macro, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the right answer.
Isn't that the answer?
That was my answer.
His third question was, why not do more to integrate structures in classes, e.g. structure, and he says, structure introspection sucks. Can't dispatch off the structures, at least not portably as far as I know. Maybe I'm wrong here, but you can you? Deaf struct and deaf class are just far enough apart that knowledge about the syntax of one causes memory mistakes in using the other. Of course, I speak only for myself. Maybe everyone else handles this with a problem.
Right. I have to remember what actually got into the language. In the Xerox implementation and in PCL, there was a meta class called Structure Class. Is that in the actual spec?
SPCL is not in the spec at all, no. There's no guarantee that structures are actually logically spelled.
Right. So the answer basically is... it's coming back to me. So that was in the PCL implementation. You have to remember that... Yeah, so this is what it was. The rest of the Common Lisp committee was already kind of pissed at us. Because far too much torque was going into CLOS at the expense of other parts of Common Lisp that could have gotten cleaned up. Gabriel was on the CLOS thing, Moon was on the CLOS thing, Danny was on the CLOS thing. You know, everybody was on the CLOS thing. And if we had come back and said, we also want to change Deaf Struct, they would have said, you know, forget it. You guys were supposed to come up with an upward compatible extension to the Common Lisp that did objects, and it was supposed to take 6 months. So that was just a non-starter, fixing Deaf Struct. But we did do it in the Xerox implementation.
And for what it's worth, any implementation based on PCL, for example, SPCL, all it does have structure class. Can dispatch off structures as types. I think that was an oversight, something they didn't have the time to do.
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to meet a deadline.
Mike Weber asked a question. He asked for your opinion on how to avoid meta circles in a principled way, or ensure their absence mechanically, in other words, automatic verifications. So if you implement, for example, generic function lookup with using generic functions themselves, you introduce some meta circularity. Because you need already generic function lookup when executing the implementation. You can break this meta circle by not using generic function lookup, which you are about to implement, by special case unit. The problem is now how to detect all possible meta circles, because they might only happen in a single execution path under certain circumstances. And he says that he would like to know whether you think it's feasible to use verification methods like model checking and so on to find them.
Oh, yeah, so this is actually, I mean, this is a very interesting question. I think it goes to one of the things that's sort of profoundly wrong with the CLOS map design that I didn't really realize until a few years later. But that if I had read Ryan Smith's thesis sort of the 10th time, it's embarrassing that we didn't realize it. So Brian used to say that the important thing about his thesis was two list, not three list. And that the important thing about two list was that two list got quoting right. And here's why that matters. In CLOS, you can write the following horrible piece of code. Let's say you've got a class, airplane, and it's got up and down methods. You can write a method on apply method, so a meta-level method on apply method, and the body of that method can just have a call to down of airplane. Right? Or I shouldn't say down, because that'll confuse us what I'm saying. Have a call to land of airplane. It turns out that's just a horribly bad mistake that we let you do that, and here's why. You're supposed to be at a meta-level. And now you're using base-level code, unquoted. And so syntactically and in the type system, there's no way to detect the fact that here you are at this meta-level. Right? In two-list, you would have been forced to say reflect. Basically, you'd have been forced to say down before you could call that code. Well, that's what two-list does. Two-list forces you to say, in two-list, you would have had to quote those identifiers and call reflect to get down to them. And if we had done that, then your type system, it would be a dynamic type system, but it would still be the type system. Then the type system would be able to detect for you, you've got some meta-level code, which is itself dependent on meta-level code, right? Because it's sort of making a call to itself. I think you could get that to work out. But you'd really have to go back and take more seriously the two-list contribution. And I really think, we screwed that up. We didn't really... And I know why we didn't, right? We thought we were getting performance. I mean, we were getting performance. But... And I'm not even sure, to be honest, you could do it with the dynamic type system. To really get it to work right, you might need a static type system. But there's been a lot of work, like the work on staged computation and stuff. There's a lot of work there now that ought to make it possible to get that much better. We didn't get that right at all. In our world, you just wait till you get a Stack Overflow and see that your extension depends on itself.
Question here from Cyrus Harmon. He said to ask you what the hell you're doing with all this Java crap. The question's a bit facetious. I'm sure a lot of listeners have the same thing in the back of the mind. Why would someone who has done such fantastic work in Lisp over the years, why would he move on to this Java crap? I mean, a lot of us have to work with Java or C or Perl in our day-to-day jobs, but would prefer to be working with Lisp. I think as an academic, you have a lot more leeway in the sort of things that you choose to do. What are you doing with all this job stuff?
Well, remember that when we started Aspect J, I wasn't an academic. And also remember that academics only have more leeway to do whatever they want in the sense that their salary will still be paid. But the thing that gets you research grants and graduate students and dot, dot, dot is it's doing whatever you want. It's doing something good. you know,
come back, Greg, your oldest were given.
It's an unanswerable question. There's no way to answer this question publicly without offending somebody.
I think that was the right answer.
But, you know, think about orders of magnitude. Think about how many aspect J users there are. So, you know, we're sitting in the list, and you could either go the ML direction, right, or the aspect J direction, or the Java direction. And Java was a strategic opportunity to get a bucket load of users and demonstrate that, you know, average programmers could understand these new ideas. That experiment was undoable in the Lisp context. And at the time, I had a boss who basically said, you know, you got to show that your idea has real traction. So, I really think at the end of the day, the challenge to you know, the challenge to the Lisp community is to figure out how to get what matters to them to work in the modern world. You really always have to sort of say, eh, you know, where can I get the 80% that really matters? And at least Java is pseudo-dynamic. What is it, C? How's a garbage collector?
We should probably take some questions from the group here. When you ask a question, if you could just come a little bit forward to speak into the mic, please.
Or I can hand it to you.
Somebody else has.
Before you were talking about expressibility, and I understand why you went, or at least I think I do, why you kind of went into the aspect J over the MOP, because the MOP is just like huge. It's hard to hold in your mind alone. Doing that in a group would be hard. But I get the feeling that at a text level, aspect J, or any of the aspect oriented, is just as difficult. So do you see any difficulties in that maybe like intentional programming could overcome, or do you think it's enough that it's expressible at the text level?
What do you mean at text level?
Well, like for example, you were discussing refactoring and stuff like that, and that's really what intentional programming is to get at, is that you hold the entire program in some machine representable code that's not just ASCII. Whereas with aspect J, it really is, it's ASCII that has to be lifted up into the compiler and then worked on. And is there a competition there, or is there something you can work with or work together?
Between aspect J and intentional programming?
Yeah.
Come on, you can't ask me this question.
Well, no, is there a difficulty? Because I was looking at aspect J as well, I was looking at aspect C++, and just like trying to sell that to other people was difficult.
Okay, so, I mean, the reason you can't ask me this, right, is, I mean, you know, Charles is my former business partner, so,
okay.
I'll tell you one thing, okay? Yeah, aspect oriented programming might not be protocols reflection, intentional programming. You know, those are three different ideas that are more compatible than they are conflictual. You know, meta-object protocols just, reflection just says, you open up the interpreter so that the end programmer can get in there. Non-object protocols just say OO programming is probably a good way to engineer that process. Intentional programming just says, well, instead of there being one metaobject protocol, the protocol that takes the code and compiles it, there'll be two metaobject protocols, the protocol that takes the code and compiles it, and the protocol that takes the code and renders it on the screen. And we let the programmer get into both of those. So good old-fashioned, you know, lisp-style syntactic macros are a trivial version of a compile protocol, but it's not object programming. There is an IDNF recurring programming that isn't in any of those, right? which is the idea that hierarchical modularity isn't the whole game. The idea that there is this thing called cross-cutting modularity, and you should have access to it. At the end of the day, you know, at the end of the decade, I'm pretty confident that all of those ideas are going to be in play. They already all are in play. So, I have a student who has this nifty little tool that gives you the render metaobject protocol by basically taking a look at the annotation. And instead of just dumping the ASCII text out onto the screen, it parses the program, looks at the metadata annotation, and says to that metadata annotation, how would you like to spit this out onto the screen for editing? And of course, the default method just says, spit out the plain ASCII. But then he does lots of wonderful things. And that idea is clearly going to be in general use in the textbook in 5 years. So, you know, I don't see any obstacle. So that's just my prologue, sorry. I don't see any obstacle. I don't see anything about AOP that is fundamentally limiting with it being text-based. That isn't a problem with anything else being text-based. I do sort of think that sometime in the next 10 years, we're going to let go of text-based code for all of its problems. And I think that will help out AOP, but it will help out lots of other things as well. SFC++ has a particular problem, okay, which is, you know, first it was C++, then they added, you know, Bjarne's a good guy. Bjarne is a good guy. But C++. That thing is just, they are just crammed into a hole. The only reason we got SFJ to work is that, you know, say what you want about Java, but Java is actually a reasonably clean language. I mean, I can tell you all sorts of horrible things about it. But, you know, given the historical legacy that it tried to be true to, Java is a pretty clean language. I don't believe that we could have done SFC better. SFC, for example, is a much cleaner language. So I think that's the real issue with SFC++, is you're starting with something that has kind of had so many things crammed into it that there's just no room left. And those guys did, I think, about as well as they could conceivably do. But that thing is not a simple thing.
Remember my real question. So have you seen Context Cell, which was Pascal's recent paper though?
Yeah.
Now, I use Context Cell to make my living. Greatest thing in slice bread. So I'm actually just wondering what you think about Context Cell, the ideas presented in the paper, specifically in the implementation as well, and how they built upon your work. And as far as I'm concerned, taking the best parts of your work and just making it. So, is that something that suits you?
I mean, it's dynamic binding of functions.
And coming from someone who makes a living using it. That actually works, like, in a...
I'm sure it does.
So.
I'm absolutely sure that it works. You know, one of the things to remember is... So I have this story, right? And the story is that when the Smalltalk team demoed Smalltalk 74 the first time, what's really important to know is that what people were amazed by was not the language. Because let's face it, Smalltalk, and it's not a bad language, but there's not a whole lot there. What they were blown away by was the programming environment. Because it was the first time anybody had ever seen a programming environment that understood the program. It was the first time anybody had ever seen a programming environment where you could point in a line of code and say, so what happens when this executes? Why am I saying this as an answer to your question? I'm saying this because the reason that works is that in Smalltalk, unless you use, unless you override no such method, the inherited structure is declarative. And because it's declarative, the programming environment can understand it without executing the code. So I actually think that one thing that people often, that people like, to remember, there's two sides of the world that look at aspects there. There's the side of the world that say, oh my God, why is it more simple? And then there's the side of the world that says, oh my God, why is it more powerful? From your side of the world, the thing to remember is, it's the fact that it's a weak declarative language, as opposed to a much more powerful imperative language, something like context-del, that I think makes it scale. So the fact that you, one person, really smart, managed to make your living with context-del is not surprising to me. But one of the good things about SFJ is that I can have a team of people, and they can write a library of point cards. And then another team of people can load that into Eclipse and say, so what the heck does this point cut mean? And Eclipse can show them four or five different visualizations of that.
So is that a language issue or is that a tools issue? Could we not achieve that with the MOP, the amount of introspection we've got?
No.
No?
No, because the MOP is... No, because the MOP is imperative.
Okay.
Right? So you'd have to sort of do program analysis.
Kind of do it, yeah. Fair enough.
Basically, programming language designers make languages weak, and that's the rub, right? Is making it weak enough that you can make the tool, and strong enough that you can say what you need to say. And I believe that, SFJ and the CLS MOP are two different ideas.
Do you think the people that can understand AspectJ are not the same people who can understand something like MOP? Do you think that you're what we call your average, programmer, is gonna have no trouble with AspectJ, which is still a very complex beast?
I am certain that the accessibility of AspectJ far exceeds the accessibility by orders of magnitude. We're down at least at the 50% mark.
And do you think you can take it down further? Do you think that you can somehow make these concepts clear to someone who really just doesn't have a mind them?
Okay, so look, without sounding obnoxious, let's think about what's below the 50% mark. Because that's visual basic, that's people for whom Visual Basic is complicated. Okay? There's a lot of programmers like that, okay? But that's people for whom Visual Basic is complicated. I don't believe that there's ever been a technology in which the original innovators had the insight to carry it all the way to there. It's going to get all reformulated and somebody else is going to do that. I have no idea how to do that.
Logo?
Right?
What about Logo?
What about Logo?
In a sense, you said nobody started down that level.
Yeah, you know.
I'm not saying it's a very powerful language, but it's possible to change the language very easily, and you can't do some sophisticated things. again, I'm not trying to defend it, just to say that no language is done.
Well, no, I didn't say no language. I might be wrong, but what I said was for the original innovators to take it that far. Logo's tricky. I'm not sure how many children. That's what makes it tricky.
I'd say that's probably.
Because you're equating children with. See, I'm not sure that the three dimensions line up. Certainly the kids in the original Logo Lab. You know, when Marvin had his daughter, Seymour had the lab, Marvin would bring in, you know, his, you know, it's sort of like, okay, well, Marvin Minsky's daughter is probably pretty smart. You know, and if she's not, her dad's sitting there. So the original experiment certainly weren't clean. But I know a lot more kids that use Logo today. I don't know, that's a good point. That's a fair point. Oh, but that was the same bullshit. I've met those kids. You know, those were kids, you know, oh, my dad works at the Stanford AI lab, so I'm going to go have an experiment at Xerox PARC, and, you know, I'm going to be sitting, you know, next to Alan Kay for as long as it takes for me to figure this out. I'm not knocking that work, okay? Those people are fantastic. And Alan Kay is the only true genius, but it was a selective environment. But maybe my point about ethics is wrong. I might just be completely wrong. I'm just saying that if you can get to 50%, that's pretty doggone good. Let me rephrase my point that way.
Okay.
My follow-up question would be, if you'd be able to make better models than us 10% to do the job of the other 50% in half the time, that's obviously just me being facetious at this point.
I used to make that argument.
You know? Yeah, I think that might be where I picked it up. So,
What changed
along those lines?
There's a heck of a lot. You know, one thing that changed is I've come to meet more people who do enterprise IT. And there's just a heck of a lot of time spent, you know, making this very particular application. I do believe that productivity tools can optimize a lot of that. But if you look at the way the industry is structured right now, it actually does a reasonably good job of putting people like you kind of down in the basement where you belong doing the kernel infrastructure, and other kinds of people doing, you know, this particular stream. And that all seems to be organized pretty well, actually. And the other thing to keep in mind is, you know, it's easy to sit here and sort of say, well, those people, they're not blah, blah, blah. But they have a whole bunch of other skills, right? They're very good at, you know, working with the customer and understanding exactly what the customer wants. And so, you know, I do believe that software technology is going to make things more productive. But I no longer believe that, you know, anytime soon there's going to be 5% of the program. Let's sure as heck hope that doesn't happen, because we're all totally hooped if that happens. Certainly those of us in the education business are totally hooped if that happens. And as are the rest of us.
Well, somebody's got to write the compiler.
There's always someone writing the compiler.
But if it's down to 5% of the program,
it's just not going to happen.
19 out of 20 programmers, the remaining programmers are not going to be able to
do it. It's just not going to happen.
Is that what
What else? You've got it's clear that you're totally prepared. You could have emailed me this ahead of time.
I think the
little
team needs to wait for this meeting for a while.
Given the success of the MOF install, why do you think MOF ideas haven't been more widely adopted in other systems? I mean, this is a fabulous...
Now, these are Karl Rove questions, right? Because you can't answer the question without affirming the thing that you don't want to affirm. So the way you answer a Karl Rove question is you say, I disagree with the supposition. You know, I'm not sure it's really true, right? I mean, Java has some op-like functionality in it. Right? It has, you know, less than CLOS and less than Smalltalk, but more than C++ and more than it would have had. You know, so why does Java not have a full intercessive mop in it? Given their focus on security, they would never have even contemplated such a thing. And if you were to contemplate such a thing, I'm not sure how you would do it. It might be possible with recent results in type systems, these sort of stage types and things like that, it might be possible to pull that off. But I, at the time that they put the reflective functionality into Java, that technology just didn't exist. So I actually think the mop technology has done pretty well for itself.
There's Steele's quote. We brought a whole bunch of C++ programmers halfway to Lisp with Java.
Yeah.
You know, that's not a bad thing at all.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I made that comment about the Java Smalltalk companies. It's the same with the Lisp programmers. The Lisp programmers who looked at Java and said, well, somebody's going to have to build the virtual machine, are making big bucks. You know, sometimes you have to deploy victory. Or if you can keep making money right in friends, that's great. But sometimes you have to deploy a victory.
Is this friends? You guys write friends?
Syntax is actually the best part of that language, but...
Or with all the black arrows, yeah. So what about, like, you know, what about that expression-based Java? You know, with that, don't see lack of syntax as an advantage. Firstly, the conceptual overhead of holding a syntax in my head. I'm a web programmer, so I need to know on a regular basis, like, four languages. I gotta be able to speak HTML, I speak JavaScript, I need to know testing style sheets, and whatever language I happen to be writing the dynamic program in. So one of the big advantages to writing in Lisp is the fact that I use the same syntax for all of them. I've got CSS, you know, the expression CSS translators, and all my JavaScript's done in expression.
Yeah.
That is a big advantage.
You're not going to get that argument. I mean, again, the world is a weird place, right? Because the world spends a long time telling you that, oh my God, we don't like Lisp syntax because everything looks the same, blah, blah, blah. And then XML, oh sure. The problem with Lisp syntax was it wasn't bad enough or verbose enough, nor did it use enough bandwidth. But now that we've got this, we'll take it. The world just, you know, sometimes...
No, it comes down to the angle brackets.
Angle brackets.
No, what it comes down to is it has to be time for an idea. And if one version of an idea is tried at the wrong time, then that version is forever dead. And you have to wait until the right time and try a different version of the same idea. That's what I've come to believe.
Perhaps on another note, I don't know, we were talking about syntax and perhaps being tied to an ASCII representation of code and anything. Do you see structure editors like in the Interlisp system, I believe, coming back or something like that? Well.
Well, I mean, I guess I do see structure editors coming back. The problem with the question, the problem with the word structure editors is that there's many people for whom they take the word structure editor to mean the worst possible kind of structure editor. And, you know, as of 1986, Mike Dixon wrote S-Edit, an Interlisp structure editor. At that moment in time would already allow you to click anywhere you wanted and type. I guess my comment about refactoring basically says that structure editing has already come back. Well, that's what refactoring is. You know, and the fact that in Eclipse you can open up a class browser, pick up a method, and drag and drop it to another class, that's structure editing. So, structure editing is back. If you call it structure editing, there's any number of people who will have a hissy fit. But if you call it refactoring, it's all good.
More questions? Chance to ask your tutor anything you wanted to ask.
It's kind of not supposed to be here. He's my student. Ask him how you do blazing fast. Ask him how to do blazing fast AOP in Java. That's where he's going to get.
How do you do blazing fast AOP in Java?
See, they're not going to ask you because it's Java.
No, I just asked. Not bad.
Yeah, I used Java before I went to Lisp. I've come the other way, right? I saw Java. I saw what it had to offer, and I saw what, you know, everybody had done with Lisp. And it's kind of looking back and like, and that's, I knew why we were doing Java. It was to get everybody on the same page. You know, maybe we'll have to spend 20 years on the same page before you move on. And probably not, it's not going to be common Lisp. You know, but I think the concepts, you know, the Graham statement, not that I'd like to quote Graham on audio, but is that basically, you know, every language is slowly becoming Lisp or Lisp-like, or, you know, the dynamic, if you will. We're moving from static to dynamic, and obviously that's because our hardware, you know, is getting faster, and I mean, I got, you know, 4 gigs of RAM in my web server, so yeah, I can run Lisp applications. Programmer time is cheaper than RAM now. So do you see that?
Is your RAM cheaper than,
yeah, that's what I meant.
So let me ask you a question. Is it Ruby?
I don't like syntax. And there's a significant flaws in the design of Ruby. I don't know if Matt's going to be listening to this, but he knows it too. There's significant flaws in the design of Ruby. For one thing, impossible to compile. Almost impossible. If somebody writes it, it takes 20 years to write it, you know, compiler code. And so I still think that's relevant. I mean, I still think the performance trade-offs are relevant. Because as much as programmer time is more expensive than RAM, you know, when it comes to certain fields, you're always going to have a lot of computation to do, and you're always going to, you know, have a lot of a big problem to solve.
The thing about this, programmer time is more expensive.
Your students, yeah. Well, you know, like, for what I charge in an hour, you can buy yourself 2 computers at the flea market, you know? So
you know, the problem with the programmer time thing, you know, Google will disagree.
Google wrote their own language, though, MapReduce.
Right, but, well, it's a language program. It binds into lots of languages. But John Lamping, who, you know, I worked with at Park, when he went to Google, you know, he sent me an email saying, you know, it's really interesting. I now measure efficiency in kilowatts. So if you scale, efficiency still matters.
What I see with Common Lisp was an attempt to make a great trade-off between efficiency and dynamicism. And I think it was done really well. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of critics of the Common Lisp standard for where it was and what it was trying to do. I think it's incredible piece of work. And then and to add something like the mob on top of that, increase dynamicism without reducing the performance too much. You know, yeah, it's a unary function is going to be slower than the function. Do you see that as a general trend? Are we moving towards, you know, more dynamic languages? And should we stop worrying about performance and just go for pure expressiveness? Or because the work on the static language is the exact other way, isn't it? We're kind of moving towards, you know, being able to statically type an entire program and therefore generate efficient code, and I don't think provable correctness has ever been an issue in the industry.
You know, you're not going to put me in a position of defending the static type system, people.
I'll wait till we put off the microphone.
They would say a different thing. The thing you have to remember about the static type system people is that, you know, the Java type system represents what they knew how to do 20 years ago. Like every other feature in Java is at least 20 years old. What they can do now, you know, with, you know, there's these things called state types and all these other type systems that are much better at expressing subtle properties of programs much better at letting you say the things you want to say. So, this will be a first that I'm publicly defending these people. You got to give them a little bit of a break. Arm or leg, take your choice, but a little bit of a break. In terms of moving to dynamism, we've always been moving to dynamism. I mean, that's sort of the oldest fact of language design, is you're always getting later bindings. Maybe not as late as you want.
So the ideal, you know, infinite clear time, infinite memory, and infinite dynamic language, infinite late binding, if you will?
I just don't know what that means.
Well, no, but neither do I, but I thought maybe you would.
You got the type of the person takes the first chapter of the commitment.
At the end of the day, you know, the person wants the answer. I mean, the other thing is, look, so one of the things I learned from Hal Abelson is that the most important thing about designing a system is to design it so that at any point in time it's really easy to tell what can't be happening. Because when the bug happens, the more you can say, well, this can't be happening, the less you have left to figure out. The reason this is an answer to your question is that static properties of systems have some very nice properties, right? Which is that
establish what can't be happening.
There's a whole lot of stuff that can't be happening.
Agreed. Right? Agreed.
So, you know, it isn't just about dynamism. Because just remember, the people who believe most in dynamism also believe in fight or flight sleep. So, it's about structuring programs so that they have just the flexibility that your system needs and no more.
So,
because more flexibility costs you a lot.
Something like the Python compiler, which is SPTL and CMUTL compiler, they have a model that low debug and high or low speed safety levels, it's declarations or assertions. Now, when it compiles the code, it actually does, you know, like a static spec check. So I mean, there's got to be a mix of both somewhere, right? Like there's an amount of dynamism, but you still want to be able to prove something. I think that's why McCarthy wrote Lisp in the first place. You want to be able to make proofs of you know, your programs.
Yeah. Anyways, let's do another one. Somebody else wants to ask questions.
Any questions?
What's the last book you read? Fiction.
Fiction? Harry Potter. I'm reading Harry Potter to my kids.
Oh, yeah. It's a good book.
You must have some more in there.
No, I've gone through my list.
Oh, my goodness. Your list seemed like it was endless.
But,
okay. Get these questions.
If there are no more questions, did you have more questions?
No, I was just making you make it a personal list.
Oh, I thought if there are no more questions, I'd just ask you, what question do you wish we had asked, or that you've always something? Is there anything that you feel that you'd like to say or to comment on that you would like to give to the group?
I have to. I don't think so, because you were incredibly well prepared, and helped me remember a lot of the things. I mean, you know, I do wonder why Lisp, in some sense, didn't do better. There are a lot of things I learned about why Lisp didn't do better that we tried to do better in Aspect J that are worth remembering. And I think two of the biggest lessons are, I just say this because, you know, it was kind of in there and I saw this happen. And I was puzzled about it at the time, and then later I figured out it was really wrong. One is that, you know, those three little companies just fought each other like dogs. And it was just the stupidest fucking thing ever. Because, you know, they had 0.1% of the pie, and they were fighting each other over it. And the other thing is...
That may be why Java, one of the Java's like developers has a single driving force.
Well, it has a single driving force, and there was a clearly defined enemy. And there's another reason why Java did well, which Laura Hill explained to me. She said, if you want to make a new programming technology take off, you need to do it in a tight labor market. If you do it in a weak job climate, it won't happen. It has to happen in the kind of climate where people can say to their boss, if you don't let me write in Java, I'm leaving. It's quite an insight, but...
They also had a clear model of what they were trying to do in the very beginning, which was that this was like designed...
But that's not why it took off, because the model changed four times.
No, I didn't say that was why it took off, but they started from a clear model.
Yeah, lots of things started from a clear model. The other problem that Lisbon had, which I think the Java community did not have ever, is that the Lisp community had a fundamental lack of respect for its users.
Respect for who?
For its users. Mm-hmm. Not for the best of the users, but for some of the users. So, in essence, you know, they had ripped off the top 0.1% of the market, and they liked those people, and they weren't very sympathetic to the next customers. Right? If you look, for example, at the Mac OS bar cards, right? Right? You look at ITS, right? The word was loser, right? When you're calling your customers losers, it's just there's something about that. That's just not really, you know, the customer is always right attitude. And I think at the end of the day, you know, there are going to be some customers who do some really stupid things, and maybe once you leave the customer site, you kind of get in your car and go, man. But at the end of the day, if your fundamental attitude towards the customers isn't, these are good people trying to win, and my job is to help them win, and if they're not winning, it's my fault, you're not going to win. And I really think that the Java community did much better about that. And certainly, you know, the one lesson that we took on the SOJ project was, if they read the documentation and wrote a stupid piece of code, then it's the person who wrote the documentation's fault.
Very unlikely.
And I actually think, you know, you can't replay history, but if they had fixed those two things,
but if you think about the times, it would have been difficult because with a very small pie, as you said, that they're fighting for, and a lot of dollars.
But the point is, they should have fought for a bigger pie.
The argument there is that the perception was
no. Symbolics was a losing proposition. I love Symbolics. I worked there. I learned a ton of things, but they were in our hardware world. I mean, that just couldn't work. They were confused about their business model. I don't think that could ever work.
So, just kind of an open question. If you were to recommend one problem for, say, high school students or undergraduates to look at right now, the people who are going to be solving the next generation of problems, what would you say you want to solve?
In computer science?
Yeah.
I thought you might have been talking to you like Paula.
Skynet, no, that's not good. I saw a movie about it.
Been there, done that. Oh, have you been following the autonomous space?
I don't know what's the most important problem, but I know what I'm going to work on.
Yeah.
I'm going to work on exclusivity. See, I still think that programming is the most important intellectual contribution of the last 100 years, because I still think that this executable knowledge, right, it looks like intentional it looks like not in intentional programming sense, but in intentionality sense. it looks like text. It's a formal symbol system, but it runs. There's never been anything like that before. I just still find that the most fascinating thing that ever happened. I realize that other people think DNA is important, and I'll have to give them that, but I still think this is pretty important. So I'm going to work on expressivity, because to me that's the heart of the field. But I don't know what's the most important thing to work on. That's just the thing I'm going to work on.
I just want to start talking about DNA as a program that I used to find it.
You still need to write programs and programs.
Yeah, we need four uploads and a bunch of codes.
Well, no, no, no.
It's something to be able to understand the program.
You need something to understand the program.
Okay, anything else?
Thanks for your time.
All right. Well,
and thank you for coming.
On behalf of the group, I'd like to thank you for coming, and we really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Now we can apologize to Bruce.